As the session goes, welcome back those of you who came back for day two, and welcome those of you who are new for day two. My name is David Vesey. I teach philosophy at Grand Valley State University in Western Michigan. I'm a St. Olaf grad. That's the sort of the Lutheran credibility of my background that allows me to be here talking about these topics and issues. And my specialty is hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is the study of interpretation, more generally, study of interpretation. I go right up here. It has it's an old Greek word. It has its roots in, supposedly it's connected to the god Hermes. The god Hermes is the god who's the messenger between humans and the gods. So the gods would often, Oracle Delphi would say very sort of mysterious things, and we need someone to interpret this. And in many of the great epics, you have Hermes who's sending the messages back and forth. Hermes is also the god who guards you for journeys. So Hermes is in charge of the transition times in your life. That's Hermes who does that work. Hermes is in charge of language and speech. He's also the one who protects the thieves and the deceivers, right? Because anytime you have language, it's not just for the sake of truth. Hermes, there would be sort of things that would mark boundaries. You know, these sort of the stone things. And Hermes, the spirit of Hermes was thought to exist in those markers of boundaries. You're about to make a transition. In the end of the Iliad, sorry, I just want to tell the story. At the end of the Iliad, there's a chariot race, and one of the young fighters is joining the race against all these great legends, Achilles and so forth, and his father is there. His father is one of the older wise men. He said, "Here's my advice to you. When you get to the turning point, be sure to stick close to the post." Now, that's just good advice, right? It's the shortest distance. But all the Greeks would have read that and said, "Yeah, that post, that's where Hermes resides. You turn around when you reach the boundary. You know, now you got to come back." So when you reach the limit, when you reach the, and all the Greeks said, what this is about is when you reach turning points in your life, stick close to the gods. So what I want to bring this out is because this is the standard way in which the Greeks would use these ancient texts to read the meanings back in and allow those meanings to speak to them today. You know, so even if you weren't a charioteer, you would have an understanding of what that meant. That meant at turning points of your life, stay close to the gods. So what I'm trying to set up is that for Greek-speaking people in the ancient world, there's a long history of reading messages and things other than what might be there literally about, you know, a turning point in a chariot race. So last time we talked about the idea, and this will come up later, last time we talked about the idea that not only do humans interpret things, interpret themselves, make sense of their lives, but it really is distinctively human. I mean, I want to say it's really something that makes us human beings is that we try to make sense of things by telling stories about ourselves. We had that line this morning, that great line where the angel asked Hagar, you know, "Where have you come from and where are you going?" You know, and there's another ancient Greek saying, "Know thyself." And I want to say that answering "where have you come from and where are you going" is the answer to know thyself. That is how you know thyself. You tell the story of your life. And the story is a story that makes sense of who you are, where you come from, and where you're going. And last time, so we talked about that last time. We talked about some of the things that make it not so obvious, make it problematic. For example, that you are not in entirely control of your own narrative of who you are, right? You're sort of more of a co-author of your life with your friends and with the traditions you're born into. Much of your own life is not in your control. So we talked a lot last time about, people talked quite a bit about the ways in which they had access to the stories of their parents and previous generations, because much of our life we're born into, we didn't have any control over that. We're raised in a world of values long before we have any say. We're already well-formed long before we have a real say about who we are. And discovering who you are is tapping into those stories and locating yourself in those stories. And then taking responsibility for yourself in the context of those stories, deciding what to make of them, to what extent are they, is that persisted through you, and is that going to be part of your life, is going to be part of where you are going. We also talked about examples of things about you, just sort of facts about you, and there's all sorts of facts about you, which are trivial facts about you, but there's some facts about you that are really important facts about you, that really say something about you. And we often read these and interpret them differently in different people, where we think it means one thing and it turns out to mean something else. And this opens opportunities for us too. We go, "Well, I never thought about that before. That could be me." You know. So we talked about these questions of identity and the ways in which your stories could shift and change and be brought to light, and you can learn something about yourself through this interaction with other people who think and live differently. Today I want to talk about, let's see if I got sort of a note. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. I'm going to be using notes a little more today. This is a big point. It strikes me that I think this question, which I love, is that where have you come from and where are you headed? That we have a moral responsibility to try to answer this question. That it is possible to live a life without asking or answering that question. Right? But by trying to articulate and answer that question, you also try to take responsibility for your life. Right? And the more you can answer that question, the more you're able to say about where you come from and where you're headed, the more you're able to take responsibility for your choices. The more you're able to answer, when you do something, this is why I did it, and I know why I did it. You know, the more sort of conscious you are about what's shaping you and what's driving you and what values are really your own, not just what values happen to be the ones that are at work in who you are. Okay, so I want to suggest, and we'll get this later in the week, is the kind of obligation we might have to become articulate about ourselves. And then what sort of limitations there are that are keeping us from becoming articulate about ourselves. Today I want to say that if we look at the way in which texts are interpreted, texts, works of art, not talk about people, but just how we read something to make sense of it, we can learn things about how we can make sense of our own lives. And I want to focus specifically on biblical interpretation, because there's a great, you can do some, look, maybe I should talk about some morals from just this.
Isn't there a fifth?
Oh yeah, what do you got?
Some who believe it literally.
Literally. But that's not what they did. So the example is what exactly, it's a tough word, because it doesn't mean yes, they all believe it literally is the answer, but they mean it literally in the sense that Augustine says, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. That's literal because it's about creation. He also says it's allegorical because it's also about the origin of our sin in us. So in that sense, it's literal, but it's not literal word for word. It's about what it says it's about, literal. You know, so the understanding of what counts as literal has changed enough. So I'm wary about what... So they're all going to say, yes, it's literal. But what we mean by literal is not always what we mean by literal. Does that make sense? No?
Well,
yeah.
Because you know that now there
right.
are some that will say, okay, everything stated is equal to fact, and literally 7 days, creation is 7 days.
I mean scientific fact, the way we see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
The one of the principles that you find, and it comes from Philo of Alexandria through Origen in the early church, is the idea that everything in the Bible is true. All right. No one disputes that. Everything in the Bible is true. The question is, what does it mean? And what he'll say is, well, there's lots of things we know are true. And these things we know are true. The Bible is true. So there's no way the Bible could contradict these things. And one of the things he points out is, for Philo, who's got this Platonic notion of God, but also for Augustine, is God could never change. So every point in the Bible which it suggests that God has changed his mind, there's a change in God, that can't actually be a historical fact about a certain sort of occurrence. That has to be something else. It's true, but it's true in an allegorical sense. It's true in some other sense than what it says.
Well, Ray McKeever says, everything I tell you is true. Some of it may have actually happened.
Yeah, there you go, right? Yeah, sure. Some of the morals we get from interpreting in this story are that in this one you need to be concerned about consistency across texts. So consistency is something to watch out for and be concerned about. Some of the other morals is that you're always looking for insight. I've mentioned that already. Another moral is that the interpretations are always informed by what we know. And here, this is clearly necessary when you get to allegorical interpretations or prophecies. Right? The only way you can make sense of a prophecy is to already know how it got fulfilled. In fact, one of the points from this is that the people who were writing the prophecies didn't actually know what they were saying. So Luther's line is the Psalms are about Christ. Right? He says the literal meaning of the Psalms is Christ. I mean, I think he says the meaning of the whole Bible is Christ. But the literal meaning of the Psalms is Christ. And in what sense is that literal, right? Those use differently. But the point is, David, who wrote the Psalms, didn't actually know what he was writing about. We know now what he was writing about. The prophecies didn't know they had an idea there was something to come, but they didn't realize when there is a reference to a lamb in Psalm, we all think, well, that's Jesus, right? They didn't know that. Because we have this understanding, we can understand that when there's talk about a lamb brought to slaughter, this is Jesus' sacrifice. All right. So there's another point here, and that the authors are not always, I was just to be sort of controversial, authoritative. I just had to use the same word twice in there. But the authors don't always know best what their own writings mean. And this is actually a common principle of interpretation. Is that people don't always know best. And you see this, for example, you see this in works of art, maybe most obviously, is that you will have the artist, you'll make something, and you have a crit, and you're talking to people, and they'll see all sorts of things that have never occurred to you. Right? And you can realize, yeah, I'm learning about what I made from somebody else. You would think I would know best, I made it. Right? But that's not really how it works. I mean, when you have Freudian readings of Hamlet, now maybe you want to say, well, maybe deep down Shakespeare knew he was writing something Freudian, right? This is what Freudian would say. But really, he could not have known what he was doing was giving a kind of Freudian model of a relationship between a son and a mother. Right? So in a sense in which Shakespeare is not the best interpreter of his own plays. And in the case of prophecy, these people are not the best interpreter. They don't really know what they're saying. What they're really saying will only become revealed later. I want to mention a couple other... I mean, I'm choosing these on purpose. I mean, there's lots of other ways to read text. I would say that. I'm choosing these on purpose because I'm trying to find models that help us better think about what it is to interpret ourselves. And one of the big questions, and we could talk about this for the rest of the time, I'd love it, is to what extent are you in the best position to tell the story of your own life? Right, to what extent are you really the best author of your own story? To what extent are you really the expert on yourself? And maybe you are. I mean, who lives me more than me, right? I mean, I know all sorts of things about myself no one else knows. Doesn't that make me in a better position than anyone else to... But can't you... Isn't everyone willing to admit that maybe someone knows them better than they know themselves? I think when you're young, everyone sort of says... When I talk about this with my students who are like 17, 18, they all say their mother. Right? Everyone thinks their mother knows them better than them. That never changes, yeah?
Recently I read a book by Thomas Merton, the monk.
Oh yeah, sure.
And he wrote an introduction to the Bible. I guess Lifetime Publishing House said we're going to have another translation of the Bible, but we need an introduction. So he said, how do you introduce the Bible? So he finally wrote one, but the new translation never worked. So one key thing he says in it, I like it a great deal. He says, when you ask the Bible a question, the Bible will speak back at who are you that wants to know?
Yeah, it asks you a question right back. Right.
That you will know.
Yeah. That's great, right? Yeah. But that's part of the idea of a sacred text, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not really engaging it, you're not really even reading it. You know?
Part of the problem, though, is we don't necessarily understand the language. But there was a passage... I don't remember, it was in the Old Testament, something about, and the people were clean of teeth. And I thought, oh, oral hygiene.
Yeah, good for them.
No, they were starving.
They're so, okay,
they
good.
Nothing to eat, so their teeth were clean.
So, this is a good example. So one of the, some of the other examples I was going to mention, one is, comes from Calvin. He calls it the principle of accommodation. And the principle, and this is your example, the principle of accommodation principle of accommodation is the recognition that these texts were written in a context that made sense to the people writing them. But that doesn't mean its meaning is only bound to that context. But it does mean you have to know what it meant to them. Right? So this is sort of the start. And Calvin, influenced by the humanists, and the humanists were very interested in getting texts right. Let's get authoritative editions. Let's make sure we get all the, we cite everything and get everything clear. Same story. It's like, well, we need to know what they meant by the teeth were white in order to understand what it has to say to us. Which is an odd conclusion if you think the important thing is that it speaks to us. It's like, really? The more I know about what it meant then, the better it'll be able to speak to me. Isn't that just the opposite? Aren't I just sort of locating the history now and sort of killing its contemporary relevance? I always say, no, it's just the opposite. It's only when you see it that way that you start to, the meanings come clear, right? They're starving. They're not just good dent, they don't just floss, right? Yeah. So that's another issue, principle of accommodation. And there's another one. This is another Augustinian one, and that is that interpretation is for practical, not intellectual purposes. He says it's so. Augustine says charity is the mark of a good interpretation. Charity is the virtue of love of God. So you've interpreted properly if it stirs your heart to the love of God. Yeah. Which means it's not about knowledge at all, really. Unless that knowledge stirs your heart to the love of God, right? It's about transforming your character. Right? It's about changing you such that you are a better Christian. This is Augustine's line about this. That's what matters. He was influenced by Jerome was the teacher, and Jerome said, it's the spirit, not the word. It's the spirit, not the words that matter. It was the line, something like that. Look that up, so make sure you get it right. You can find out the exact interpretation, but that's the idea. Right? The idea, the concern about it's literal, that, you know, that starts in about the 19th century with the rise of science. You know, you just don't see this back then, in that narrow sense of literal. Okay, so here's all sorts of ways to think about the text. I want to add one more, and that is you need to be concerned about the audience of the text. This is something we take seriously. Who is the text written for? And part of this is just understanding the context. So we know that 1 Peter, whom we have now, the author says at the beginning, I'm writing this to these people. We know that these people were Gentile Christians living in non-Christian lands. Right? And because we know who the audience is, we now know that we can now read what he's saying in the letter to better understand. Yeah?
How is that distinct from the principle of accommodation?
Right. So it's one way in which you can do the principle of accommodation. If you take principle of accommodation, just simply mean you got to read in context. One of the contexts you want to take is who is it written for. Yeah. If the principle of accommodation is just simply that the words and ideas that are being put forward are words and ideas that will make sense to people at the time, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's not. Maybe it's one of the specific ways in which you would sort of play out the historical concerns. Yeah, I'll think about that. Yeah. Because there'd be a lot more, right? You'd wonder about exactly who the author is, exactly how to best translate it. You know, you'd want to know. I Scott gave me an example about, we now know better about, because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, what the Jewish community was like at the time of John the Baptist, so that when these authors, like Matthew, who was very concerned to show Jesus to be Jewish and to connect Jesus to Jewish traditions, we now have a better idea what he would have thought of meant to be Jewish at the time and the range of possibilities that fell under that, and now we can get a better idea about what his audience was when he wrote this, right? Things like this, you know? That's all part of the... I guess I'd say that's part of it. I want to separate it out because I think it matters when we talk about telling the story of your own life is who you're telling it for. And the reason I started thinking about this is because yesterday we had some examples of I don't remember, the gentleman's here again, but he talked about having family reunions once a year. And part of the family reunions was to sort of make sure his kids kept getting the story of the family. Right? Because they would go off in the year, like, we got to sort of keep remembering the values of the family that we wanted them, and that they know the family story. And he was telling the story. The story of the family was for the children. The audience of the story was the children. Right? And we had the example, it was your family, right, that didn't tell you the story, right? And he wondered, why not, right? Maybe there was sort of, you know, you would think that if you're telling sort of the story of you and your family for your children, it's probably a cleaned up story, right? Unless, you know, maybe they're adults, or at a certain age in which you give them the whole story, or maybe never, maybe they have some things that are going to go to the grave with me, and maybe that was your family, right? It's all going to the grave with us. But so there's a real question about when you're telling the story about where did I come from and where I'm going, you're thinking about, who am I telling this for? Am I the audience I'm telling this for, to understand myself better? You know, because that's a different story if I'm trying to help my children to understand where I'm coming from, where I'm going, or my wife to understand where I'm coming from. You know, or if you say you're dating somebody, right? There's sort of the classic example, right? You're dating somebody and you're trying to sort of figure out if your lives work, you know, tell the story together. So I wanted to separate the audience one, because it seems like it's such a central question to ask yourself when you're telling the story, when you're trying to figure out and narrate your life. Okay, that's why I wanted to get up there. And the reason I want to get up there, because I want to say that, you know, when it comes to doing a good interpretation about your own life now, to tell a story of your own life, it needs to make sense. It needs to be consistent, right? It needs to sort of actually contain the important events in your life, or say something about why what seems like it should be important events weren't. I mean, maybe you were in the World Trade Center at 9/11, and that's not an important event. I mean, it'd be amazing if someone didn't have that as sort of an important event in their life, but you could imagine someone said, no, it was just, that was a tough day, right? And then we went on, or something like that, right? It would say something about them. Maybe that's not the best example, but the idea is that there are things that your story has to be consistent about where you're coming from, where you're coming from, where you're going. And if it's a story of transitions and changes and revolutions and conversions, you know, that has to be recognized in the story. It's a story that should tell you something. It always should provide insight. It's a story that should provide practical insight. That is, if it's really a story that gives you insight in yourself, that helps you understand yourself, you now should be able to live more easily. You should be able to understand better the choices that you want to make and should make, and why you are the person you are. And that should have practical importance above all.
Are we talking about biblical interpretation still explicitly?
No, we're moving now into talking about you and your life.
This consistency is actually not, that's a fiction,
right,
of sorts. So you're actually, there's a creative process going on.
What you want to do is not just sort of make yourself consistent, like I'm always consistent. You want to make sure your story fits the facts. So guess what I have in mind by consistency? That's why I immediately said there may be changes and revolutions and transformations, and I was like this once, and now I'm not like that anymore, mm-hmm. Right? But you want, it shouldn't be the sort of thing where you say, well, who am I, where am I coming from, where am I going? If someone knows you, say, what are you talking about? That doesn't sound like you at all. What about, you know, this whole period, you know? I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which we have a certain blindness of ourselves, and consistency is a way to sort of try to take that seriously. Yes, sir?
It kind of occurs to me, this, like, who are you and where are you going?
Yeah.
Isn't that really what a lot of politicians are saying?
What? Who are they? They're trying to take hold of that narrative, right?
And you get into the same thing. You get into the consistency, you get into the story is different depending on the audience.
Yeah. Right? Absolutely. They're all trying to sell a story. All right. Yeah, exactly. Because that's how you understand them. That's how you connect with them. That's how you decide they fit with you, right? That's the way their identities line up. And you say, that's the man or woman for me, right? Is they're trying to sell you a story. But then you get suspicious when in different contexts you get a different story, right? So there's consistency across contexts too, right? This is where you talked about this, right? The different contexts and how they raise different sorts of issues. I was thinking the principal accommodation is when you sort of, some of these are, you look back in your life, you see things as foreshadowing, right? You say, I look back now and I should have seen that coming. Yeah, now I can look back and now I understand better where things went. That was much more of a pivotal moment than I realized at the time. Right? You can probably think of something like that where you thought it was no big deal, and looking back, you realize, wow, actually that changed everything.
you know, we were talking to a pastor. I asked him, how did you become a pastor?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, from my childhood, people were telling me, you're going to be a pastor. You're going to be a pastor.
Yeah.
But he said, I didn't believe them. But then he said, afterwards, you know, several stages later, it was validated by people who were not known me from childhood. And they all validated my talents and things.
Sure.
And I tend to believe them. So maybe those people were prophesying.
Exactly. In some sense, he can look back and see it as a kind of prophecy, right? Kind of foreshadowing. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking this, the analogy here is that you see patterns. You recognize patterns in your life. Right? You recognize patterns in the past that persist in the present. Themes that carry on that seem to be more than just coincidences. You know, good or bad habits that we find happening over and over again that we recognize. This is more than just something I do. This is really something part of my who I am, for better or worse. Often it's the meanings of the events that are more important than the actual event. Right? It's what you take from them as you look back and say, well, you know, it wasn't so much that, it was what I realized in that moment, right? Or what I took from it. That's sort of more of the allegorical way. I'm trying to sort of tell the story about how thinking about the ways in which the Bible got interpreted by some people in a particular historical window can lead us to think about what we might think about when we try to understand our own arc of our lives.
David, it caused me to think of the homily at Vespers last night, which seems to be a classic example of a biblical text talking about, you know, Jesus calling the disciples right on the seashore or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chuck thinking about his own experience, his own brush with death, and interpret and hearing that, you know, same call to come follow me in his own life. And that experience of falling off a cliff then is not simply falling off a cliff. It is hearing God's call.
Yeah, exactly. That just becomes the occasion for what really matters.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, good. Yeah, thanks. I was on baby duty last night, so I'm sorry. I'm the little babies with us. there will be the trio. There are two things I want to pull out, though. One is this concern that you may not be the best person for telling the story of your life. And this concern about who exactly are you telling your story for? And I want to give a concrete example, maybe the sort of the greatest example of somebody narrating their lives. And that, I mentioned already, that's Augustine. We're going to load on here. Those of you back, we'll stop and we'll see. Augustine took that seriously. He believed he was not in a really good position to best understand his life. And he took this very seriously, too. Because Augustine believed that the defining fact of everybody's life is that you come from God. That your relationship to God is the defining fact of your life, and any narrative that doesn't include that is evidence of sin. Right? Because you don't recognize the most important thing of all creation. And Augustine said, so I know this fact. It's a matter of faith. Augustine's famous knowledge is faith seeks understanding. I know this fact. I don't really know what it means. You know? It says, and this shows me that in a very deep sense, I don't know who I am. And I can't know who I am as long as I'm sinful. Because what is sin but distance from God? So Augustine here at Augustine's, hey, we're talking 3, are we just from memory? No, I better not. I would have got 354 to 430. So, an early church father. His mother was Christian. He got seduced by philosophy. He was a Platonist and then a Manichaeist and eventually converted. I talk about sort of the moments of the voice of God, right? The sort of famous story about how he heard a voice in the garden and take up and read child's voice, and you open the Bible to Romans. There's one chapter that said, you know, about put away all your vices. And that was in 386 is when that happened. He became ordained in 391, became a bishop. He lives in North Africa. He's in the Roman part of North Africa. Bishop in 396. And between 391 and 428 or so, he wrote 100 books, 200 letters, 500 sermons. We have by far more writings from Augustine than anyone else in antiquity. And we know this because 2 years before he died, one of the last things he wrote was he went back over all his books and he wrote what he thought was still right. And so we have a catalog by Augustine himself of all his books, and we have almost all everything he wrote. So it's a pretty amazing sort of thing to have all this writing. I mean, library of writing from one person. And many of the religious disputes, or the, one of the go-to guys for religious disputes at the time, and the time was rife with religious disputes. But in three, this is what really kicks our names. In 397 and 98, he wrote the Confessions. And the Confessions, which is, amazing book that everyone should read. It doesn't mean much for me to say that, right? That's your assignment, is read the Confession. It's 13 chapters. The first 9 are his story of his conversion to Christianity. It starts when he was born. It starts about how sinful he was as an infant, because all he was about me, right? For Augustine, that's the original sin right there. Infants just it's all about them. And he goes through growing up, going through these various sort of philosophical positions, but also all his willing submission to temptation over and over again. There's a famous line where he says, "Give me chastity, God, but not yet." You know, it's like that. I'll be chaste. Does that be tonight? You know, maybe after this weekend, maybe chastity then. Until he eventually converted. And the book itself is Augustine's, at the same time as a story about his, it's his story, where have I come from? It's also a story about his discovery of God in himself. Because for Augustine, any story about where you come from is a story about God. And any story about where you're going is a story about God. And the only way that you're in a position to actually tell your story is if the story is coming from God in you. So the story of your narrative must always be a story to God in you. And the audience of the book is God. Because if there's one person who knows you better than you know yourself, it's God. The book is, actually, if you read it, I don't know how people read it, you're expecting this sort of biography, autobiography, and it's mostly prayer. It's prayer and praise, and because when you're writing to God, that's what you write. You know? God knows the story already, right? Almost the whole book is, and the word is a confession, right? Isn't that what the confession is? You already know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to tell you anyway because I want you to know that I know too. All right? And I recognize that in this moment, I really do know. Right? It's sort of acknowledgement of a self-clarity. And, you know, the moral of self-clarity is sinfulness because I recognize God. And so this is the book that is sort of one of the great, I mean, it's really about the first autobiography, one of the first self-stories of where did I come from, where am I going? And Augustine makes the case there's only really could be one audience to that story. And that story's audience, it doesn't have to be your kids. Maybe you want to tell them a story so they understand your family. Maybe for your own self-understanding. But if it's really your own self-understanding, it's really understanding of God in you. Yeah. And if that's not your story, it means you haven't even started to understand yourself yet. You haven't even got to the point of the mystery of what it means to have God in you. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to sort of say today and talk about the ways in which reading these things help us understand ourselves better, and the way Augustine all of a sudden raises these issues that make it very complicated and difficult to think about. And the next person, so I would do questions and discussion for the next 15 minutes. I just want to say the next person we're going to talk about, if you want to come back, is Kierkegaard. Somebody who the idea of God in you meant nothing but a kind of terror. Maybe appropriately so. So, all right. So tell me what you're thinking about this now. I've laid this on you.
Well, it strikes me then that thinking theologically is inherently a thinking autobiographically,
yeah,
on some level, and vice versa.
Yeah. Well, I think vice versa more than. Versa more than vice, or something like that, right? I mean, I think, wouldn't there be a certain sort of, speaking of vice, wouldn't there be a kind of pride? I mean, how about this? Is that, here's how, can I put it this way? It sounds like maybe it's the same thing. that any thought about God has to be thought about a road to God as well. Mm-hmm. A life lived on route to God, something like this, because that's often, in that sense, it's autobiographical, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How about this? Any thought about God is also, you know, what is it? You look at the Bible, it says, first of all, who are you?
Yes.
Yeah, any thought about God says as much about you and where you are as it does about God. Yeah. And how far it falls short says more about you than it does about God.
Sure.
Is that part of the same idea, the way that you're sort of caught up in the... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't not be caught up in
it. Making God our own image kind of thing?
What's that?
Like making God in our own image sort of thing?
Does it have to make God in our own image?
Like we see God through the lens of
our
experience.
I think for Augustine... Well, okay, yeah, I want to sit. We start asking these things, it's hard, it's a standard thing.
Speak ex cathedra.
From the chair. Thanks, God. There is, I mean, to the extent you want to say we see God in the world, and the extent you want to say we see God in each other, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be such that it's such a failing, right? That's not all there is to say about God, right? You don't want to say, and that ends the story. But it also, I don't think you want to get to the point where you're saying, there's nothing in this world that's like God. Which is a saint in the Quran. I guess I'll own up to that. Because it's a very different view then, right?
That's true.
Yeah, it's a very different view about the relationship between the world and God.
It's not incarnational.
Right, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Is there any significance to the fact that Martin Luther was an Augustinian, or is that just
absolutely
a coincidence?
No, there's of course great significance to that. You know, one of the ways in which it's very significant is that Augustine. So we heard about Abraham this morning, right, in Hagar. So Abraham was able to be right with God well before Moses showed up on the scene. That shows it's possible to be right with God without going through all the laws and institutions and hierarchies and structures. And so Martin Luther saw that as a moral, that you don't have to go through the priesthood to be right with God, because Abraham was right with God before Moses came along with the commandments. In the same way that many of the early church figures said the same thing. We don't need to be Jewish. We don't need to follow all the Jewish laws in order to be right with God. Abraham was. So, and Augustine saw the same thing. The highest thing you can achieve is a kind of personal relation to God. And that belongs to the same tradition. So I would think absolutely there's a connection between Martin Luther and Augustine. At least, I mean, I'm sure there's many, many more than that that many people could bring up, but that's just the one that strikes me right away.
Yeah. A thought to share, I don't know if this is appropriate. A few years ago when I was in India, we were cleaning up my parents' house, mm-hmm. and I found a diary of my dad, mm-hmm. written in 1924 when he was 19 years old,
great.
Starting a bachelor's degree, mm-hmm. and every single day he wrote like a spiritual thought, sometimes it would be from a poem or a Bible verse, and he would write a lot of things, and it was always about serving humanity, helping people, to think better of others, things mm-hmm. like that. So I found this complete diary for the whole year.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, I'm thinking about publishing it.
Yeah.
And what you've been saying today is so meaningful, because I know what my father's ideals were when he was 19, mm-hmm. and how he lived his life for 73 right. years, and what he's achieved and where he failed. So these things will be very useful when I put it together. Mm-hmm. And to see who the audience will be,
right.
what the prophecies that he, without right. knowing, said, and that got fulfilled.
Right.
So it's really amazing that I came to this class today. So really think.
That's great.
Okay. Yeah.
So can I ask, as you saw your father age, I mean throughout his life, and you saw the ideals that were in this 19-year-old's book, did you see them lived out in his life?
Yeah, most of the time. Yes, he was a great achiever.
Yeah.
He was a doctor till he was 55.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went into ministry as an honorary pastor.
Right.
And
that's great.
He did many things for the local people.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that he had high ideals.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't reach them all, but he really tried.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think when where have you come from and where are you going?
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say, well, here's where I'm going. And it's another thing to do what it takes to discipline yourself to make that become a reality. And it may be that you reinforce these ideals day in and day out, everywhere you find them. You say, that's it, I'm going to ingrain this in my spirit.
Right,
so
and
that
I always wonder
that
why am I publishing it? Who's going to read it? You know, the grandchildren may not be interested now. But I believe that it will be.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. I'd read it. That would be great.
Okay. I said, I'd love it.
That would be great. Yeah, okay. Well, I'll buy a copy. Yes, sir. Did you have your hand up?
No, okay.
I'm not going to call people with their
hand up. I also remember from the Confessions, the way in which Augustine at one point talks about, he's got this line about how looking back on his life, he discovered the kind of grace of God ever present in his life retrospectively. And so like he can tell a story of his life looking back on it with much more coherence than he could ever going forward. And that he sort of God's presence was something he sort of recognized with a backward glance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the moment he could never have seen that at work.
Yeah.
I would dare say most of us can say that.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Yeah.
We didn't know at that time that it was God who was more than the situation or decision.
Mm-hmm.
Now looking back we say, yeah, that was the it's God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
So was Jesus one who could tell his story well? His own?
Yeah, boy. I don't believe that. Brother, I gotta sit down. I gotta sit down.
That's a sit down question.
Yeah, because to what extent? Yeah, I don't want to go. I don't know what to. I'd have to think a long time about that.
Yeah.
Well, if Jesus' speech was mostly a parable.
This is exactly what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Telling a story.
Towards, you know.
He did say, I know who I am and where I'm going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Okay, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long is it going to take? 3 days.
But even he did spend time in.
I guess I don't know. There's so many levels of way that question might be coming at me about the role of the nature of the incarnation and the way that this, you know, Jesus' own knowledge of himself as God and in the incarnation.
Yeah.
Leave that for the. I'm listed as a theologian this week because there are sort of holding categories that are different than other categories. And so anyway, I mean, it's obviously religious themes, but I want to leave that for the professional.
I think we all love to tell that story.
Yeah.
It's part of our evangelism and our faith.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but part of being a good witness is being able to articulate your story. And
that
interactive with it.
Sure.
Our story and Jesus' story.
Isn't that the classic?
It should kind of
intertwine, right? And isn't that sort of the classic sense of witness?
Mm-hmm.
You witness is the way you tell a story. And we talked yesterday, about the ways in which others shape your story, interrupt your stories, maybe inform your stories in ways you didn't realize. I mean, the example was your shirt, your jacket, right? Bright color. Never thought about this. Wear bright colors, and what is it saying? There are ways in which then the is that your best friend is the one who corrects your story by saying your real story is a story about your relationship to God. Something like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
The witness. The witness who says,
helping
you know,
you see that.
Right, helping you see that that's your story too. You know, in ways that your actual friend, I mean, in ways that becomes complicated. We all know how complicated that is. Yes?
There's
a lot of complications here. One of them is your truest story is not necessarily the best story for the person that it's being told to.
Right.
Okay, and secondly, the best telling of the story mm-hmm. is not necessarily the best telling of the story for the person. If you're talking about telling a religious story, mm-hmm. if you lay out all sorts of things very clearly and somebody might consider that the best story, that might leave the other person cold.
Right.
There might be other ways of telling the story where, in fact, you left something out and they had to struggle
mm-hmm.
to try to work on what the story meant and got some insight through their own struggle. So
absolutely.
We're dealing on a level of intellect
yeah.
that I think we're leaving out all the some well, other levels that are really important when it comes
sure.
to interpreting, living,
mm-hmm.
Witnessing, whatever.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that and I don't mind how complicated it is. I think that's right. It's really complicated. It's really complicated in interesting ways. One of the things I'm going to talk about on Thursday is emotional self-revelation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the ways in which you come to understand things about yourself through your emotions, or maybe there's richer words than emotions. So that's not as intellectual. Maybe that's not exactly what you're talking about. But I think that, yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's if what I was saying way back at the beginning, that it's you have a responsibility to narrate your life, to tell where you're, even if it's not a religious story, to tell where you're coming from and where you're going as a way to own your life. It has to be your telling. Someone can't tell you that for you in the same way someone can't offer you, someone can't give you freedom over your life. You know, you have to acquire that yourself. That sort of, those sort of insights have to be won by yourself. Go ahead, you too.
I say, as pastors, I think we're always preaching, and like Augustine says, you can't know your story unless you know
it.
God's as part of that story, I think,
mm-hmm.
from a Christian perspective.
That's the Augustinian line, yeah, exactly.
So can an atheist then not know themselves?
That's what Augustine said.
You have to accept that part of the equation, that God is the idol, before you can actually know yourself?
That's Augustine's line, yeah. You only know yourself through God. That's what he's going to say, exactly.
So Augustine would say no, then.
To what? The atheists cannot know themselves.
Actually know themselves.
Yeah, atheists cannot know themselves, right? Yeah, exactly.
He'd say that God helped them to know themselves even though they didn't believe it.
Yeah.
There's some sort of subtle distinction here, right? That they know themselves, but they don't believe that they know themselves. Right, yeah, they're sort of in denial about themselves. It's an extreme view, right? Is that fair?
I'd like to add about the piece about audience as well, that, like with Augustine, for instance, you know, it's more complex than the fact that, you know, God is perhaps the ultimate audience. That's a highly kind of pedantic text. He's writing to help, rhetorically, to convince people of the truth of Christianity, too.
Mm-hmm. And so that he's an appropriate person to be a bishop.
What's that?
That he's an appropriate person to be a bishop. He's gone through all those sins too. He's paid
right.
his dues. And, yeah.
So to say that God is the proper audience is a little, it's more complex than simply that God is the audience for the text. I mean, he's writing for the significant overhearing of a great number of people.
Yes. it was published. That's
yeah, right.
Thing, right? Yeah,
right.
It's not like you,
right. the people
in
the house,
et cetera.
You know?
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I guess when I was thinking about audience, I was thinking about when you're writing, and this happens all the time for writers, who is it you think is your ideal reader? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you have all sorts of non-ideal readers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yes, it has the text is playing all sorts of functions for Augustine
right.
because of that. But I think that if you want to understand, it can be frustrating reading it unless you keep that in mind, because you keep wondering, why are we spending all this time in praise and prayers and on and on and on? Half of it seems to be just how great God is. Yeah, we got it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us the story about you and sleeping with the prostitutes again. that's the good stuff. But no, so, but that's what it is. For him, it is, for actually, I think we're out of time, this will be so, but I think for him, it's maybe it's something like, what your father did. For him, it's a kind of spiritual exercise. At the same time, it's a public document. At the same time, mm-hmm. it's a kind of, for him, it's a kind of spiritual purification. It's a kind of a ways in which, that is, it's hard to, how about this? It's hard to, like your father, it's hard to imagine him doing this for a year and being the same person at the end when he began, right? It's hard to imagine Augustine being the same person after writing this that he was before. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just a self-discovery, it was a self-transformation. All right, well, thank you very much for coming. Thanks, you too, for... Yeah.